Keith Whitaker is an educator who consults with leaders and rising generation members of families with significant wealth. We had an interesting conversation touching on Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, but also on Keith's long practical experience working with the wealthy. We talk about the cycle of the gift in families, the concept of magnificence, and his work on books concerning wealth with Jay Hughes, Paul Shervish, and his recent collaboration with Tom McCullough on the Wealth of Wisdom books. Keith Whitaker is Managing Director of Wise Counsel Research. He is the co-author of Wealth and the Will of God, The Cycle of the Gift, The Voice of the Rising Generation, Family Trusts, Complete Family Wealth, Wealth of Wisdom, The Top 50 Questions Wealthy Families Ask, and Wealth of Wisdom, The Top Practices of Wealthy Families and Their Advisors. Keith has served as a managing director at Wells Fargo Family Wealth, an adjunct professor of management at Vanderbilt University, an adjunct assistant professor of philosophy at Boston College, and Keith holds a PhD in social thought from the University of Chicago, a BA and MA in classics and philosophy from Boston University. Keith is one of the most thoughtful people in the family wealth world, and his knowledge of philosophy and respect for tradition make him a real pleasure to talk to. Please enjoy my conversation with Keith Whitaker.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Anything said by the guests or host should not be construed as legal or investment advice. Thanks for listening.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background. I could be very easily talking to a philosophy professor right now.
You could be. I guess I'm a recovering philosophy professor, never recovered. Yeah, so as far as my background goes, I did my educational work in political philosophy, so specifically classical political philosophy, wrote my dissertation on Plato, and that basically prepares you for one task in life, which is to continue to study political philosophy. And so I did that for a while in academia at Boston College in the philosophy department. And then I realized that the academic path was probably not best suited for me in terms of writing specialized papers that one or two or maybe three people would read and grading student assignments. Although I did enjoy working with students and thinking about the books. So I started to do some work through Boston College in the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy, which was led by Professor Paul Shervish, helping Paul write various papers on philanthropy and its conceptual framework. And then my main project with him was a book on the subject of Christian theology and philanthropy. So what we could learn from different Christian thinkers about how to assess your own resources, assess the needs of others in the world, and go through a process of discernment, connecting resources with needs. And that was a lot of fun. And then that kind of helped me transition away from academia proper to working within the world of family offices. And I started by helping families specifically around philanthropy, setting up private foundations and thinking through the process of decision-making and communication around their giving. And that led to then working with families more broadly around family dynamics. And so through a whole series of events, I ended up being part of a firm that we sold to a big bank and was lucky enough to help start an internal practice within that bank, which was one of the real first internal practices in a financial institution devoted to family dynamics, to the qualitative work, as Jay puts it. And then from there, realized that just as I wasn't really best suited to be in a university setting, I also really wasn't best suited to be in a big financial institution with the various constraints on thinking and writing that entails. My partner, Dr. Susan Massenzio, and I decided to go independent back in the very beginning of 2010. It's a very auspicious time in the financial industry to start a new business. And happily, that did work out. We founded Wise Counsel Research and have been consulting to families, family offices since then, as well as doing a fair amount of research and writing and sharing those ideas with others in the field. So that's been the last 14 years.
This interest with family goes way back. Your PhD was Plato's Laws and the Foundation of the Family. Was there any particular reason why that caught your attention?
That's a good question. So in political philosophy, the basic question of political philosophy is, what's the best regime? What's the best shared way of life for a community? I should say the question of classical political philosophy changes in the modern world. But, and so I was very interested in that question. And when you ask that question about a community, you immediately run into realizing any community is more than one community. Right? There's cities, and then there's neighborhoods, and then there's these things called families, which seem remarkably resistant to many of the attempts of political leaders to enforce ideology or change upon them. And this is obviously a very important question in the modern world. What shape, is there a nature to the family? What shape is most healthy for individuals within a family? What's the connection between the family and the larger community? And so I was interested in those questions. And that led me to Plato's work, where famously Plato in the Republic, Socrates argues that the most just city would be one where there are no families whatsoever, right? That everyone would consider the city itself as his or her family. There'd be no private families. Of course, that seems to conflict with every actual human community that has ever existed for any period of time, apart from a few strange experiments in the 19th century. And so I wanted to look at Plato's treatment of the family. And then very interestingly, there's another very long work of Plato's in political philosophy called The Laws, in which the family plays a pretty prominent place. And in my dissertation, I was comparing those two works and trying to draw out the lessons there, which basically I took to be that, by according to classical political philosophy, yes, justice demands the elimination of the private family. However, since we can't get away from the fact that we have bodies and that we feel erotic attraction towards others and we feel longing and even despair in the face of our own deaths and hope for something more than this life, we're not going to eliminate families anytime soon.
So let's maybe carry that forward a bit. Where does family fit into society according to Plato's student Aristotle? Because to him, it was an important part of society.
This is going to be an interesting podcast for your listeners. We're going to get deep into classical political philosophy here of the 4th century BC before we get back to Jay Hughes in the 21st century. So you're right. In Aristotle's Politics, specifically in Book One of the Politics, Aristotle treats the family as really the foundation of the growth of the city. However, at the same time, and I think that's because Aristotle starts closer to the ground of what is and what people say about what is in political life. But even there, Aristotle indicates that there are really defective things about the family. But if the family pursued its own principles to the utmost, he likens it to the cave of the Cyclops in the Odyssey, right? That each family would have its own little world of father, wives, probably plural, children, all cut off from the rest of the species. And that's clearly defective, both from a political standpoint, and also Aristotle makes the case that from the standpoint of the individual's flourishing, that to be fully what we are as human beings requires the political community, requires stepping beyond our families to connect at work with, learn from others in the larger community. And that's both to meet our own needs, although you can meet a fair amount of needs in the Cyclops cave, but most importantly, to truly live an excellent life.
One of the first things Jay recommended to me about your work was you're talking about magnificence and Aristotle's concept of magnificence. Could you talk about that a bit and maybe how we could relate that to philanthropy today?
Sure. So let me back up here a bit. So Aristotle and his other major work of political philosophy, the Nicomachean Ethics, talks about moral virtues and virtues of habit that allow us to live well together. And there are several of these moral virtues. Some of them are very familiar to us, like courage, moderation, justice. And then there are some others that are a little more unusual, I guess you'd say. And one of those is magnificence, it's called. And magnificence is the virtue of giving large amounts of money away in the right way at the right time to the right recipients, et cetera. And so it's unusual because it's a virtue specifically of money, but of large amounts of money, because there's another virtue called generosity that deals with small or middle amounts of money. And this seems to have a direct connection to philanthropy in our experience. And there's many interesting things about magnificence, but one of them is that in Aristotle's account, unlike when we think about philanthropy, magnificence could be not just giving away large amounts of money, but spending large amounts of money. So it could be, as Aristotle says, having a lavish wedding for daughter or son or the like. It could be doing something political, aiming for a warship, as an example he gives there. So examples that don't exactly fit within our definition of philanthropy. And I would broaden that based on Aristotle's principles to things like, you know, spending well on setting up a major business enterprise, like a big deal, as we would call it, could be an example of magnificence. And so, again, there's lots of different parts that we could explore here, but I think the big thing that is missing from the discussion of philanthropy that most of us have, which focuses on things like, is the money that you're giving, is it proving effective? Is it producing results? Is it strategic in some way that's going to change the conditions under which people are living or meeting their needs? Those things are all important, but I think they miss the main point of magnificence, which Aristotle argues is spending large amounts of money beautifully in a way that's fitting, in a way that evokes wonder, in a way that gives people who behold it a sense that this is really an ordered whole that this spending is creating or reaffirming. Aristotle likens magnificence in that regard to something like philosophy or science, that you have a sense that there's an order to this world that we live in, and that this spending reflects and brings this order to a shining brilliance. And I think we get glimpses of that sometimes in large philanthropic gifts. Like I'm thinking just today, the story about $1 billion gift to a medical school in the Bronx, right? Pointing out not just the size of it, but the fact that it would allow students to go there tuition free forever, so that people wouldn't be graduating with tons of debt. It's the poorest borough of the city, so it meets a need specifically for the city in that regard. It would allow a population that's underserved to have more medical professionals available to it, developed from within it. So you can see how it connects various parts of this whole that otherwise might seem at odds with each other or somewhat disordered, and through that gift, bring those things together in a beautiful way. I have no idea the effectiveness, the impact, all the other buzzwords of that. And a lot of times in philanthropy, we don't know what the quote impact is going to be, but you can glimpse something of the beauty of it right from the conception of the gift and its initial execution.
Now, how would you contrast that with just selfishness or magnanimity or self-aggrandizement?
Yeah, so how to contrast magnificence, this grand spending, with something like showing off? Oh, that's a good question. That's a fact that Aristotle takes up later in the chapter on magnificence, where he contrasts it. So every moral virtue has two vices that are hustling at either side of the virtue. And so, for example, courage has, on one hand, the vice of cowardice, pretty evident, but on the other hand, can have the vice of being overbold, right? Being foolishly daring, right? And so magnificence likewise has two vices on either side. One is stinginess. You can have lots and lots of money and quibble like over the check with your friends, right? And did you really pay your part of the tip or something like that? And so Aristotle would see that as probably an example of stinginess. And then the other side of magnificence, the vice in the other direction, he calls something like vulgarity. Right? Spending lavishly, but in a way that's not beautiful. And not beautiful can take many different forms, right? It could be like a foolish expenditure, but it could also be that kind that's really more about the spender or the giver than about the recipient, the results, etc. Showing off would fall into that category. And the word that Aristotle uses to describe that vice of vulgarity is a very beautiful one in Greek. It's called aperokalia, so the lack of experience in beauty, right? And so magnificence, if it's pursued really rests upon the basis of an experience in beautiful things and seeking to do beautiful things through your spending. And that's not easy to do. So it's easy to fall into the vices on either side.
Do you think later Christian ideals about charity, why we don't hear things like magnificence talked about anymore?
Well, I think that's part of it. Although when you think about the expenditures of money and effort on things like cathedrals, those are very much treated by Christian thinkers as examples of magnificence, of either individuals sponsoring them, whether those were lay people or clerics, or the community that made them possible. Right? So there's certainly examples of magnificence that are celebrated within the Christian tradition. I think that there's also, of course, plenty of criticism of wealth that grows out of the Christian tradition, maybe not necessarily straight from the Bible, but there is enough in the New Testament to give some credence to those criticisms. And then I think it's complicated in the modern world because we have these vestiges of some elements of Christianity, such as within Calvinism or Protestantism more generally, which, you know, cause people to be very concerned about things like showing off, not necessarily about making money, that can certainly be approved, but using it in a way that appears to be showing off or making oneself an object of attention. And then in the modern world too, we have a repudiation of Christian belief. When Christian philanthropy or charity, as it's properly called, it springs from a recognition that suffering will always be with us as part of our lives in this world. There's no end to it. So you're not seeking to somehow uproot poverty or sickness or the like. You're more tending to the suffering caused by those things as part of our living in a fallen world. In modern philanthropy, there's quite a conscious rejection of that view of charity. And it goes back certainly to Andrew Carnegie and other John D. Rockefeller Sr., where the thought is, no, we don't have to live with these things. We can eliminate these things. We can end suffering in various ways through, as Carnegie called it, scientific philanthropy, or as people call it now, strategic philanthropy. And so I think it's a mixture of certain strands in Christian thought, but really as they're transformed in the modern world by modern thinkers to be something quite different, even opposed to Christian belief, but rather a more secular belief that we can save ourselves. That's why magnificence then becomes even less attractive, because it's like, this is just showing off and it's not removing the ills that beset us in a strategic way.
Like a museum would.
You look at museums today, they become elements or mechanisms of social justice rather than places to behold beautiful things and connect with a tradition of the creation of beauty that goes back thousands of years.
I don't mean to go too off piece, but what do you mean by that?
Oh, just that the deconstruction of the tradition and finding fault with particularly Western civilization and using artwork not as an object of beauty, but as an object of guilt is pretty much what every major, like Universal Museum in the United States, has succumbed to in recent years.
And how would you define the quest for beauty?
I would say it's part of the human soul and human longing that you can try to deny or crush, but it'll come out one way or another, whether that's through art, through literature, through the moral virtues that Aristotle described, each of which is a form of beautiful practice, all those ways.
Before we talk about your book with Paul Shervish, do you think that money interferes with a person's spiritual life?
I think it can, but there's only spiritual interference with spiritual things, right? Money by itself as a material thing doesn't have any power. It's the power that we give to it that matters. And insofar as the pursuit of acquisition or accumulation takes us away from other more important matters. Today, well, maybe 100 years ago, that might have been called a neurosis. Today, it's an issue. 200 years ago, it would have been called a vice.
So tell us about the work that you did with Paul and what you learned writing that wonderful book with him.
Wealth and the Will of God. It was a fun book to write, as I said. So Paul had wanted to do something that had a grant from the Lilly Foundation to do something on Christian theology specifically. And so we were going to start with Aquinas and Ignatius and then go on to Luther and Calvin, Jonathan Edwards. But I said, if we're going to understand people, especially like Aquinas, we really should start with Aristotle. And so that kind of persuaded Paul into that. He was very glad about that. And we did work on Aristotle too, along the lines that I just described. Now, for me in particular, I had been teaching Christian theology at BC along with philosophy. That was something that one did at BC because students were required to take a year of theology as well as philosophy. And so I was familiar with Aquinas, to a lesser degree, Ignatius, BC being an Ignatian Jesuit school, but I was not very familiar with Luther, Calvin, or Edwards. And so that was a great learning experience for me. And in part, it was an experience of seeing how these later theologians, who are often treated as very radically different than people like Aquinas or Ignatius, for that matter. Yes, there are differences there, but I saw more of the continuity of thought and the difference between those thinkers and their rootedness in Christian thought and the modern world that kind of uses their names from time to time, but jettisons most of the concepts. So just to give you like an example, in Jonathan Edwards, the concept of benevolence is very powerful. And he takes the really fundamental Christian teaching about charity and interprets it through this term of benevolence. And what's really great there is that he reminds us that charity, we think of this today in the modern world, we think of charity as like caring for others' needs, right? Like you're making a charitable donation to some nonprofit. You're being charitable towards others who are in some sort of bad situation. But Edwards, going back to the whole tradition, reminds us, well, ultimately, charity is love. And it's not primarily love of other human beings. It's love of God. And that by itself is actually a human reflection of God's love for us. So charity springs from God's love, not some human compassion or sympathy for other suffering human beings. So anyway, that's just like one example of how I saw more of a continuity in those thinkers and a discontinuity between them and much of what we talk about in contemporary secular world.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think for Aquinas, vices are a deficiency of love.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a certain deficiency of love, it's more likely that you'll be captured by something like greed or lust. But it's not necessarily and very much like Dante, it's very much a self-love versus trying to be integrated with the larger community and obviously being integrated with the love of something higher, something transcendent.
The thing that's tricky for most students, like when we're teaching these things or just normal people when we talk about them, is that today we think of love as this kind of solipsistic thing. Like it springs from me, it's mine, it's towards whatever I happen to be, quote, attracted to. Whereas for Aristotle or Aquinas or basically any of these thinkers in the great tradition, there are different types of love and there's a hierarchy of them from better to worse forms. And so to love well takes a lot of work, a lot of discipline, a lot of thinking as well as practice. It's not just something that you've got feels, as kids would say on X or Instagram these days. It's not a matter of vibes. It really is something that is a worthy practice to learn to love well. And that was something that was revived during the Renaissance, but has, under the influence of modern psychology, and has just gone completely out the window now.
And what would that practice entail? What would you have to do to get beyond, obviously get beyond the self?
Yeah, I think ultimately it comes back to pursuing a liberal education, an education suitable to free human beings. And part of that education is shaping up your ability to love well, to understand what are worthy objects of love. That goes back to what we were talking about before in terms of beauty. What is truly beautiful? And what does love seek? what are the problems or questions that are posed within love? Because it's not a kind of self-evident thing. It's not, I'm hungry, so, you know, probably it's time to eat, or I'm thirsty, it's time to drink. Like, love's object is itself a surprising and often confusing thing. And so the process of understanding that is very much at the heart of what these people call liberal education.
And does sacrifice play a role in that?
It certainly sounds like it. If you look at some of the examples, again, if you take Plato's Symposium, there's this discussion of these men around a drinking party, and they give speeches in honor or praise of love. And many of those speeches are, you know, a couple of them particularly, are speeches about the love that causes one to sacrifice oneself for the beloved. And ultimately, Socrates gives the speech which makes it sound like love. No, it's not really about sacrifice. It's about the completion, the fulfillment of yourself in the largest sense of uniting with beauty, as he says. But then what looked like it was going to be the last word on the subject turns into the second last word when Socrates' own lover, Alcibiades, this man who loves him dearly, bursts into the party drunken. And he gives a speech where he praises not love, but Socrates. And it's a very touching speech because it shows how painful love can be when it's not returned, or when you believe that it's not returned, as Alcibiades himself believed. So the question, again, of what is the proper object of love? How do we sort through the different apparent objects of it? How do we pursue that as part of a full human life while also recognizing it's just not just about ourselves? And those are like the fundamental issues at the heart of love.
So you worked many years with Abbott Downing. What was your own journey like in learning to work with clients and their complicated issues?
It was long and ongoing and filled with lots of missteps and mistakes. And
so you can't just hand them the symposium. And
I learned that pretty early on. I did have a client once who was really interested in Maimonides, so that was helpful.
Excellent.
I haven't studied the Guide for the Perplexed for many years. But no, I think probably the most important thing that I learned along the way and keep coming back to is one of the key things that Jay points out. It's actually one of the key lessons from this tradition that we've been talking about, which is the importance of paying attention to what people say, the words that they use, right? Not going into meetings or engagements with clients, just having your script, your plan that you're going to drive home, but really asking questions, listening, seeking to learn, and also helping clients, family members, develop that habit of seeking to learn about themselves and from each other. And that's what I think one of the things that is so powerful about Jay's work and resonates so much with people is his attention to language, to the words people use, to getting people to question the words that they use, think about different vocabulary.
So you started working with Jay well over a decade ago and ended up writing 4 books with him. How did you meet Jay, and what about his work did you find interesting?
I actually met Jay 2 decades ago. So it was 2004. And that was about the time I was transitioning from academia to the work with Paul in philanthropy. And through that experience, I got to know Charlie Collier at Harvard, chief philanthropic officer at Harvard. And Charlie, of course, had been an early student of Jay's and had written his book, Wealth and Families, very much in the spirit of Jay's first book, Family Wealth. So Jay's first book came out in 1998, if I remember correctly. I think Charlie published the first version of Wealth and Families in 2002 or 3 or something like that. So I got to know Charlie, and Charlie said, you really need to get to know Jay Hughes. And so he connected the two of us that way. So it went from there. But of course, what attracted me to Jay from that early point, certainly some of the things we've talked about, his attention to the tradition of not only political philosophy, but literature, art, religion, spirituality, his attempt to learn from all of these different sources in a very humble and, as he says, with that beginner's mind way. So that was very attractive to me as a kind of never recovering academician. But I think in addition to that, it just felt to me as someone who had some experience in the financial and philanthropic world, but not a lot, but enough to recognize that there's something really different about Jay, that he was not only talking about money or plans, but about the human beings that have to live with the money and with the plans, and asking, again, that fundamental question, is this a good life or not? How can it be better? And those were questions which, you know, were not, they weren't prominent questions 20 years ago in the field. I don't think they really are that prominent even to this day outside of a kind of limited circle. So I think Jay was and is really sharing a very different perspective that is very powerful and very life-affirming for people.
Did you ever work directly with Jay with families?
So I invited Jay back when we had sold Tanager Financial Services to Wachovia Bank, and we joined Wachovia's ultra high net worth group, which was called Caliber at that time. So very early in the time that I was at Caliber, I put together an educational program for our client families. And one of the first people I invited to speak at and join that was Jay. So somewhere in 2004 or five, I had Jay join me with a bunch of families and do a presentation and do some individual consultations and such. So that was a great introduction to Jay with families. I have consulted with other families in a more ongoing way with Jay, particularly when there were issues of kind of fiduciary issues at stake, rethinking families' trust structures, trustees, relationships, trustees and beneficiaries, connecting that with family history and values. So we've done some extensive projects along those lines. But for the most part, my work with Jay has been the writing of the books and just thinking and talking together.
So the first book you did with Jay and Susan Massenzio was called The Cycle of the Gift. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that one came about. Susan and I were talking about wanting to pull together our thinking, and we had been meeting probably once a month with Jay for a while, talking through ideas. And so we just sprung the idea to him. It had been, I think that was around 2010 or 2011. So it had been a while since he had published the updated edition of Family Wealth and Family the Compact. And there just been a lot of, again, vocabulary that came out of those conversations that we thought would be really important to get out there. And specifically, while Jay had talked about non-financial wealth in Family Wealth or Family the Compact, he really hadn't had a chance to fully formulate the idea of qualitative wealth, and really sought in Cycle of the Gift to do that for a pass at that. And then also the language of spirit. No, so spiritual capital had been something which Jay had been thinking about for a long time and had made mention of in Family Wealth, but hadn't had a chance again to fully explore. And so in looking specifically at the question of how can parents or grandparents give well to their children or grandchildren, we found the notion of the spirit of the gift extremely helpful. So to give some, you know, words to what is the intention, the meaning behind the gift, getting away from the amounts of money, the quantities, or the planning that surrounds the gift, what's really at the heart of it? And that's been probably, I think Cycle of the Gift is probably the most enduring or popular of our books generally. And I think it's because of the power of that notion of the spirit of the gift at the heart of it.
What is the cycle of the gift?
That came from our discussions of Marcel Mauss's anthropology and a you know, very beautiful, very famous book that he wrote called The Gift. Yeah, in which he talks about how no gift in our language would be complete without a kind of return, even like a re-gift or a gift forward by the recipient. So in Mauss's theory, looking at anthropological evidence, historical evidence, is that the giving was a way to bind together communities, whether those are families or tribes or larger communities, that giving is a way to hold them together. And as such, giving is never just from one person to another, right? It's not just from you to me or me to you, but rather it's something that's passed along through a variety of people in this cycle, as we called it. And conversely, Maus argues, and using all this evidence, that if a gift kind of stops, it poisons the recipient, right? It has a spirit that goes bad. And so, again, we saw this in our practice. We see it all the time in our practice, that recipients who feel like they don't understand why they're receiving something. What does it mean? What is it for? What are they supposed to do with it? That's a gift that kind of stops with them because the spirit isn't clear. They can't pass it along. They can't integrate it into their life in a meaningful way. And so it does have this poisonous quality. So, I mean, we saw it in our practice before we read about it in Maus, but we found that to be, again, a very powerful way of capturing that dynamic in a way that's like very real to people. They understand it as soon as they hear it.
Do you think the upper class has a responsibility to the larger society?
I think all of us have a responsibility to the larger society. And so the question then becomes, what is the nature of that responsibility? How does it change or not based upon things like material wealth? So yeah, I think this is one of those areas of Jay's thought that, again, people find very eye-opening and they really find helpful, that just a step back. I think in his early work, Jay is very famous for bringing up the proverb of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. And there's been a lot of people since then who say, oh, that's not probably true. And that's negative. And we should be talking about positive things. But I think it was really helpful that Jay put that out there because those people do get it. And there is a lot of pain that's involved in family after family that see the wealth cause conflict and division and lead to not only the loss of the financial wealth, but the loss of the family after a generation or two. It happens all the time, right? So I think people really found it helpful for Jay to put that right out in the open for them. In addressing the proverb, Jay clearly argues that, no, you can beat this. You can have financial wealth in your family over generations and things can go well. Your children can grow up to have healthy, independent lives, yet remain connected, love each other, et cetera. So that wealth can be good for families, right? It also brings up the question, though, is wealth good for the larger society, right? And I think Jay points to that question, too, in some of his work, where he raises this question of, can any society tolerate extremes of unearned wealth in it? And obviously, there's plenty of historical evidence to say, well, after a certain point, that becomes destabilizing and people feel it's unjust and take action around it. So that's where I think, again, Jay, in his work and the work that we've done together, has always connected the well-being of families with the well-being of the larger community and seeing social capital or spiritual capital, sometimes people call it, as an essential part of family flourishing and family well-being, whether that's through philanthropy, whether that's through business involvement, producing useful goods and services for others, that families that do well have some sense of connection to a larger community. They're not just for themselves.
Do you have any thoughts on why money tends to confer moral authority?
Just to reflect back the fact that you're asking about, I sometimes to quote this Yiddish proverb that when you have money in your pocket, you're smart, you're handsome, and you sing well too. In other words, that it seems to bring a confidence and also a belief in others that you have these outstanding qualities. So not only moral authority, but just all these other things, which on the face of it's very silly because obviously money doesn't make you more handsome. And yet it is striking how sometimes very unhandsome older men end up with these very beautiful trophy wives. But anyway, why does it do that? I think it's because part money captures the longings for happiness that every human being has. And this is actually a place where Aquinas is very helpful. Aquinas calls money potential happiness because we can read into it all the things that we believe we could buy with it and that could make us happy if we bought those things, were able to make those things happen. But Aquinas uses that term to distinguish it from actual happiness, from happiness that comes not through something external to yourself, but through an activity within yourself, right? That can't be taken away from you the way that money can. So money, it's not a bad thing. It can be a very helpful thing. But if the focus is only on potential happiness, you never get to actual happiness.
This is a question I've talked to with Jay about, and certainly this is something you've thought about in depth over many years, is why is it so hard to transmit wisdom about wealth?
That's a great question. That's, again, it goes back to why is it hard to transmit wisdom about anything, right? When it comes to pursuing a career, finding the person that you love, raising your children. Almost all of us fumble our way through those three things, even though we've had parents that pursued careers that we hope found people that they love, we hope raised their children well. And yet it seems like from one generation, we can't seem to quite pass on wisdom about these things. Why is it hard to pass on wisdom about money? I think in part because of things we've talked about, the temptations to false belief that money brings with it, this belief that potential happiness can be gained through it. In part, look, if we again talk about wisdom more generally, it's just hard. It's just hard to gain for yourself, much less pass it along to someone else. It typically, as Aeschylus says, involves suffering. Nobody likes suffering, right? It takes hard work. It's another thing I think was really good about and very helpful about Jay's work is that he reminds us like this is hard. It does involve suffering. It involves talking with each other about things that people don't typically talk about, that are actually frowned on in terms of talking with your family members about. So that's something that I always remind families when we're doing this work. It's hard stuff. If you're struggling with it, then that means you're doing something right because it's hard. It's hard to do this. So again, I know sometimes people will say, oh, let's focus on the positive rather than the negative. But no, there is suffering in this work and it is difficult to do. And that's why it's hard to attain wisdom around this or any topic. And it's certainly hard to pass it on. And I think, look, the best thing, of course, is to be able to figure these things out for yourself. Very few people can do that. Second best is for us to have good teachers, and that's a matter of luck most of the time. And apart from that, you just hope that you're brought up with some good habits and a healthy society, because otherwise it's really hard to figure this stuff out for yourself. And I'm certainly not someone who's done that. I hope to attain that second category of having good teachers that I could actually pay attention to, such as Jay.
So here's an easy one. Do you have any thoughts on the wealthy's need for refinement and distinction? Is this a path to beauty or status?
So this is like the opposite of Warren Buffett. No, I'm not staying the same as I've been for 80 whatever years, but rather having bigger, more beautiful house and transportation and clothes and friends and so forth. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. You can probably tell from our conversation thus far, I think that the development of refinement by any of us is a positive thing. If it's true refinement, if it's seeking to pursue or have beautiful things that not only bring pleasure to yourself, but actually shine and make our world a more beautiful place, whether it's being a patron of the arts, having a beautiful home that's part of your community, I think that those are worthy aspirations of the use of material wealth. And it's interesting just on the subject of magnificence and things like houses. If you, like, I lived around Boston for many years. So Boston has parts like the Back Bay, especially maybe parts of Beacon Hill too, where in the 19th century, wealthy families saw it as not only good for themselves, but good for the city to build beautiful homes, right? That graced the city with their gracefulness. And have been a source of pleasure and admiration for, you know, decades or even centuries. Today, a lot of times, at least I see families with significant wealth still build very big houses, tens of thousands of square feet. But if you just take the example of some of the tech billionaires, what do? They tend to hide them, right? Literally build them in places that are inaccessible to others, can't be seen, or even like literally underground. I know people who build houses that are 30, 40,000 square feet, but a lot of it underground, so can't be seen by anyone. But I think that's an unfortunate development that it probably has a number of different causes to it, but does cause you to question, like, what are you really doing? Is that sort of more a return to something like the Cyclops cave that we were talking about before? Is it healthy for a community to have people building huge houses underground?
I'm confused about the Cyclops cave. So you're living in this cave with the Cyclops, or are you the Cyclops?
You're the Cyclops.
You're the Cyclops. You're yeah. One purpose. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Right. Do you have any thoughts on Wealth 3.0?
I'm one of those people who finds it hard enough to get to 1.0, as you can tell from my continued reading of these old books. Anything past 1.0, I'm lost on. Now, I've been told that somehow I think that I'm part of 2.0, so I don't know exactly what that means. But so, yeah, I don't really have any thoughts there other than that insofar as people continue to develop new practices that engage families, that engage members of the rising generation, and there's another piece of vocabulary that Jay developed, which it has just really, you know, taken over in the field. I think that's been a wonderful thing. As people develop new practices to engage the rising generation, that's all to the better. That's all to the good. My only concern with the fetishizing of innovation is, does it take you farther away from some of these fundamental questions that Jay has been asking?
And I've asked you this in a number of different ways today, but what do you think it is, not necessarily for you, but for others, that resonates about Jay's work versus the shelves of books that we have on family wealth?
I think the vocabulary. So really crystallizing these words that help people see themselves in a new way. So whether it's the spirit of the gift, the rising generation as opposed to next generation, the voice of the rising generation, rather than just, quote, engagement, seeing trust as a gift of love, as he talks about in our book on family trust. So these words, this vocabulary, changes the language and it changes people's way of thinking and hence changes their way of living. So I think that's been extremely powerful to people. What else beyond that? I think certainly, although it's somewhat of an underdeveloped element of Jay's thought, but it's very present there, this notion of the profession, of the personne de confiance. I think for advisors, or at least some advisors, that's a very attractive description that takes the work out of a place that's transactional or a place that's just being a servant, right? And I think that's a real danger in this field, that advisors end up basically being servants to families, and raises it to the level of a sense of profession. And again, this is something that Jay refers to many times and I think is very attractive. It's a place where I think there's more to be done, but just the notion of this work as a profession is one that's very powerful, because any profession brings with it a claim, first of all, of some knowledge. If you're a doctor, you claim to know something about human beings, their bodies, their health, their illness, and so forth. So profession brings with it that notion of knowledge, but it also brings with it a sense of some common good between the professional and the client, and also the professional and the larger community, that in turn puts limits on what the professional does or doesn't do. Like if you're a professional, there are things you don't do. You don't tell stories about your patients or your clients, right? You certainly don't steal or the like. There are limits beyond just the limits that the law imposes on what a professional does. And so I think Jay's emphasis on the personne de confiance, on this work as a noble profession, is also one that really speaks to many advisors, and of course to the family members who read this, who see this as, this work could be more than making money, saving money, passing money on tax efficiently. It can be something as important and meaningful as attending to my health, my physical health, my mental health. That, I think, gives it some weight.
You and Tom McCullough have written two excellent books called Wealth of Wisdom and have a wonderful podcast series where you talk to many advisors of the wealthy and explore many of the myths around wealth. Is there anything that was surprising that you learned from this work?
It wasn't so much surprising, but the work with Tom, which has been really enjoyable, he's been a great partner to work with too, just brought so many of the people in the field, other advisors, to us so that we've had, I don't know, 60 plus some odd contributors to the two books, maybe more like 70. So that's been really remarkable in terms of how ready people are to share their ideas, share their practices, and so forth. I think also the reception of those books has been, maybe that's been more surprising to me, is that there are quite a number of families and advisors who have taken those books and made them the basis of, say, like family reading groups. So they'll get together once a month or once a quarter to read a specific chapter, whether it's from the first book on a question that they want to ask, whether it's from the second book describing a practice that they want to try out. So I think when Tom and I put them together, we thought, well, it'd just be a nice collection and be more like a reference thing for advisors or families. But the fact that they're relatively short chapters and there's a whole bunch of them on a whole bunch of topics, financial and non-financial, has allowed families to really look at them as ongoing resources, not just reference books, that they can really integrate into their work as becoming learners together, which is also, again, going back to Jay's work, Jay has always emphasized that the key to family flourishing is that family members continue to learn individually and together. And so in a really nice way, the work with Tom and the Wealth of Wisdom books has put that into effect with many families who see themselves as learning communities and use those books to kind of give them prompts along their journey.
Excellent. Keith Ridiker, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wonderful insights.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe. It's been a real pleasure. It's not every day that I get to talk with someone thoughtfully about everything from Plato's Republic through the fine work of our friend Jay Hughes.
Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, please share it with your friends and take a minute to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it.